हरि हे ओ सहनावतु सहनाभुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्त वृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
So, mantras 4 and 5. The inconceivable characteristics of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Person possesses unique qualities. Since his features appear paradoxical and baffling to the mind, he cannot be understood by mental speculation. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that even the great sages and demigods are unable to comprehend him. Bhagavad Gita 10.2. All contradictions, however, are reconciled in his personal form, as it is confirmed in Srimad Bhagavatam 6.9.36. O Supreme Personality of Godhead, all contradictions can be reconciled in you. Mantra 4 clearly suggests that the Absolute Truth is ultimately the Supreme Person, Bhagavan. Otherwise, there would not have been any need to mention so many of his personal characteristics. The Lord has multifarious energies, parashya shaktir vividhaya shruyate, which are present everywhere. The fact that his energies are all pervasive, however, does not mean that he has lost his personal existence, or that he deteriorates. Srila Prabhupada explains in his purport to C.C. Adi Lila 7.121, quote, for example, a businessman transforms his energy by establishing many big factories or business organizations. Yet he remains a person, although his energy has been transformed into these many factories or business concerns. The Mayavadi philosophers do not understand this simple fact. Their tiny brains and poor fund of knowledge cannot afford them sufficient enlightenment to realize that when a man's energy is transformed, the man himself is not transformed but remains the same person. So that's important to note, because we will use this in our... How do you say? We use this ourselves. One is here is to establish the point that Krishna is a person. And as he expands everything, he still remains a person. Krishna makes this very clear in the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam, that even though he is expanded as everything is in everything, he himself still remains as that same person. So that's important to note. So for those who are non-devotees, then to be able to understand this fact that the Supreme Lord exists despite his creation. But also for the devotees, that's important. Because when we are attached to the creation and we're trying to purify ourselves, in other words, the element of never forget Krishna, that element is then accomplished. One is that if you can directly remember him as a person, that's of course the best. But the tendency is one doesn't see Krishna in one's attachments. That's general tendency. So the point is the only reason that a living entity can become attached to dead matter is because it's Krishna, that potency. That's one aspect. The other aspect is that it belongs to Krishna, right? One's attached to the child. But the point is the child is Krishna's. It's Krishna's child. Right, but by the Ishavasya principle, then this is your quota. Right, you want to be a householder. You want to, be involved in the experience of family life. So then, this is your quota of family members to experience that with. So that's given by Krishna. So the child, therefore, is Krishna's, and that experience, because it's dead matter in the form of a child, that you get the experience of the childness child, you know, the experience of the child-parent relationship, because that potency is Krishna. He creates the parental mood. He creates the child's mood. He creates the mood of that interaction. Does that make sense? So in this way, then you can connect it, right? But still, the connection is of the lesser category, because we're not calculating Krishna as the person. Right? Does that make sense? So that's why it's important to understand it. Just because I've made that connection, which is a very elevated position, because then you understand the principle of Brahman. You understand how Krishna, through his energies and that, has entered it. So you're understanding the Brahman and Paramatma platform. But the point is, until it's brought to the Bhagavan platform, then it doesn't have that completeness. Right? So it's Krishna as a person. He's so kind that even though I have forgotten him, have come here, he has arranged that I may have these families, members, and I may experience all this. So it's him as a person. It is his potencies and energies that by that grace we are experiencing it. The other one will give you liberation. If you understand this child, you know, belongs, it's not my child. In other words, so therefore, then the natural step is, if this is Krishna's child, then therefore I have to deal with the child as Krishna would want, not as I want. Right? That's where it comes. Just like if I'm borrowing my friend's car, I have to deal with the car how my friend would like it to be dealt with, not how I would deal with it. Right? So any possession of someone else's that, you know, has so kindly come into my, you know, how you say, sphere of usage, then I would take care of it naturally according to that other person. Especially if it's that the whole facility and everything about it is also their arrangement. Right? I could say, okay, it's Krishna's child, that's very nice. But it's also that experience you get from them as a child, that's also Krishna's arrangement. Right? Does that make sense? So everything about it is all arranged by Krishna. So then the natural thing is okay, as Krishna's child, therefore how would I take care of Krishna's child that would please Krishna? Right? And as that energy is and that potency, that experience is also Krishna's potency, how would I deal with and understand and relate to these experiences as Krishna would want me to? Right? Does that make sense? So it technically, though, our drive is we're dealing with this particular manifestation of matter, you know, combination of matter and spirit that we call the child, because of my attachment to the parental rasa. But ultimately, it's what I'm dealing with is Krishna. Right? So in the beginning, it's just the child. And okay, the Shastra says I should deal with the child like this. So I'm a little dutiful, so therefore I do it. Or I'm intelligent, I know that the only way that actually the relationship with this child will work nicely is if I follow the Shastra. But still in all this, it's that faith in the Shastra is good, that's pious. But it still hasn't come into the level, it hasn't touched transcendence. When now you bring in what Ushupanishad's talking about, then we understand, well actually, besides following that because that's just the pious thing to do or I'll get the best benefit, I'm following because actually it's Krishna's child, not mine. Right, but it's my quota. I want to taste, I have this attachment, I want to taste this attachment. Therefore, Krishna, out of his kindness, has arranged for this situation for me. So this is my quota. Right? Well, you know, quota is not just money. Quota is everything. Like even how many, you know, how many boxes of tissues you have. You know, still, it's by Krishna's arrangement. You know? So all that is then, it's good. So therefore we should deal with it according to Krishna's direction. Then it takes on a whole nother thing that then besides, one is that I do it and I see this and it's Krishna's, then I get liberated, right? Because I'm dealing with transcendence now, right? Because I'm seeing my attachment and the dealing with that, I'm seeing it from the transcendental platform. We're dealing with Brahman platform and seeing the workings of Paramatma in controlling and organizing the material energy. Right? Does that make sense? So both of those aspects are there. But then you take it further that Krishna as a person has kindly arranged this, then it brings it into that aspect. So then taking care of the child according to Krishna's direction to please Krishna actually starts to become service. right? Like Arjuna fighting on the battlefield. He's fighting for his brother to get his kingdom. But it becomes service to Krishna. Because he sees it's Krishna's, you know, war is Krishna's situation, right? That how Kshatriyas work things out. So he does that according to that. He's doing that to please Krishna. How he uses his weaponry and all that, his chariot, his Gandiva bow. It's all by Krishna's grace he has all that. He uses it, deals with it according to Krishna's direction. Does that make sense? Then it becomes service. Right? Otherwise, sitting at home staring at your baby is not service. It may be nice, but it's absolutely nothing to do with Krishna. Right? So one has to be able to take it further. Then it becomes useful in the devotional path. So in that case, then one doesn't consider, you know, that this is mine. No, it's Krishna's that he has given for my use. Right? Then you get this Ishvasya principle. Then it comes nice. And that attitude will come out in later verses. Right now we're giving what is the position of Krishna. Then it'll come up to what's our attitude and how to deal with this, right? As the Upanishad progresses. Yes.
Sometimes one gets flashes of remembrance, but how do you make that a more constant feature?
How do you make it a more constant than one's? By wanting it. So this is a little known fact, but that's what's described more in the evening class, is by wanting it only. That's the main thing. Otherwise, why did one become a devotee? There was some reason. He wanted some answers. One wanted some way to get out of the suffering of the material entanglement, whether it's physical, emotional, intellectual. He wanted some correction of that. So one takes shelter of Krishna consciousness. Having taken shelter of Krishna consciousness, then, so it's your desire, therefore you're involved in it. Now within this, now that may be the start, but now be able to serve Krishna, be able to develop that love for Krishna, come to our natural state, you know, to be able to give pleasure to Krishna. Desiring that, then things move more quickly. Like that. But you have to want it. If you don't want it, why will it come? Because even if it did come, you wouldn't value it. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So if you want, you'll make the endeavor. Does that make sense? So that's why on the material platform, material endeavor, basically we give up because we don't want that. But we make the spiritual endeavor because we want the spiritual development. So now then that's very clear if, okay, material desire, material endeavor, you know, material result. Or no material endeavor, only spiritual endeavor, spiritual result. Those two are very clear. What happens if you're in the middle? Right, so then you're dealing with material facility in that with spiritual consciousness. So you're getting both at once. You're getting the results of the material endeavor at the same time as you're making spiritual advancement. But the difference is you know it's not mine, it's Krishna's. Because as long as you think it's mine, you're never going to get much out of it. Right, the example, then one's a thief, right? That's the term used. So it's just like you have the servant in the, you know, wealthy person's house. So as long as he understands I am servant, basically the facility of the whole house, he enjoys. But as long as if he ever thinks this is mine, then he's a thief, he's thrown out. Right? So this idea, we hold on, you know, doggedly to the idea that I can claim its mind and enjoy it. But we can't. Right? You claim it's yours, you're thrown out on the street. Enjoy the street. Right? You understand it belongs to Krishna and you're willing to assist in Krishna's enjoyment, then you're happy. Right? Does that make sense? You make all the arrangements for the party, and it's a nice party, and the mood of the party, and that you're there, but you can't claim that I'm part of the party. But at the same time as, you know, the same music, the same, you know, laughing and joking, the same interaction, the same food, everything, you're able to appreciate. As long as you don't claim it's yours. As soon as you claim it's yours, then there's a problem. So this is the Ishvasya principle, as we understand who it belongs to. So that this is one of the toughest points, is that somehow or another I could get both. But that's why we're in the material world. As long as we hold on to that concept, we remain. When we give it up, then it goes away. But we're thinking, if I give it up, then I won't have it, because that's the path of gyan. Path of karma, I have it, I enjoy it. Path of gyan, I don't have it, I don't enjoy it. But what we're saying, Buddha yoga means you don't have it, but you still enjoy it. Right? Because you only actually start enjoying when you know it's not yours, when you start following the rules. Because then the element of sacrifice, right? Doing something, austerity is good, you feel good about yourself. But a sacrifice is even more, because then you're pleasing someone else. So then your austerity actually gets used for a higher purpose. Does that make sense? So then it becomes more. So this is what's being offered by these things. So these aren't like just basic or dry or that. Dry means we're only seeing it on the platform of gyan. But we're talking about how we're dealing with this on bhakti. Because Upanishads are only talking bhakti. They're written in a way that gyanis can take them. Because at least then they'll be following the transcendental path. Right? So that means they'll stay out of everybody else's way and not bother everybody. Right? Because they're not engaged in karma, so they don't bother anybody. But the point is that these things are being offered for the devotees. Vedanta is for the devotees. Right? So then the idea is that end of knowledge means surrendering everything to Krishna. Then it's simply Krishna's pleasure that you're looking for. Then whatever you have is Krishna's. All your endeavors are Krishna's. Right? So this is what's, it's not from the dry part of, okay, I got to give up everything, I got to do everything like that. It's that you're dealing with a person, why wouldn't you want to do it for them? It's just like if you have an intimate friend, then, you know, if you're together, then, you know, whatever you would eat, you would want them to be eating. Whatever arrangement you're making, you would want them to be involved in it. In fact, you'd probably do it for them. You know, instead of going, I'm hungry, you know, you want something also? You go, hey, you want something to eat? You would take it from there. So that's the difference. Okay, I am going to eat. And I want to eat what I want to eat. But I'm progressive, so I'm willing to say, hey, you want to eat this, what I'm going to be eating? Does that make sense? So that would be the first stage. But we wouldn't say that that's so deep. But it's nice. It's better than, you know, just going off and eating it and forgetting your friends. Right? So that's like you're dealing with your the elements of the karma, the nice karma there. Is that you're doing what you want to do, but you're giving it. Right? So that's renunciation. Then the other would be is that, okay, you know, that it's not that you're doing, it's that you include them in it. Right? They're included in it, but it's still along your line. Then it can go into that what they're interested in. Right? You want to eat, but what are they interested in eating? Right? But then it gets to the point of you just care about them. Are you hungry? Are you this or that? And arranging for them, you'll be taken care of. Right? If your friend's hungry and you make some arrangement for food, naturally there'll be enough for you. Right? Because they wouldn't want to just eat on their own. Like Krishna's not saying, you offer me all the bhoga and then that's where it ends. No, he's happy that you take prasad also. Right? Does that make sense? So we see it here. Okay. Does that make sense? So all it is how you would deal as a person with another person who is important. That's what the whole philosophy is about. But because we are not very trained or very used to dealing actually on a real personal platform, you know, on the transcendental personal platform. Therefore, the presentation of it comes to us through be good, be nice, you know, be transcendental, be renounced, be detached. And that's what we think philosophy is. So that's why philosophy, oh, that's, you know, been there, done that. We're talking about something real. I got, you know, my family, I got to pay bills. You know, I got to deal with, you know, the different social systems and situations I'm in. That's real. But the Bhagavad philosophy, that's what it's actually addressing. Why Nanda Baba doesn't have to pay taxes to the kings at Mathura? Right? They don't have to plant in the right season. They don't have to milk the cows. They don't have to take them out to pasture. Right? He doesn't have to take care of all this stuff. Right? But they do it all in connection to Krishna. So what will be the difference here? So reality means doing it for Krishna. So this idea is that, okay, there's philosophy, then there's my real life, means we actually haven't understood the philosophy, the depth that we can. We've caught the logical, technical points, like that. We understand the transcendental position, but we haven't understood how to take it so it's full. Our life is fully involved in it. So intellectually we understand, but as far as our emotions and our actions, that's not connected. Right? So that's the idea, is that the philosophy is taking it all the way to that. Shastras talk about karma, right, and punya. That's there, but it also talks about Brahman realization, Paramatma realization. But ultimately, the whole purpose of all of this is Bhagavan. That's what we're trying to get to, is Bhagavan realization. But it's worded in such a way that those who can't appreciate it will at least appreciate the Shastra. Right? Does that make sense? Because the point is, if there's no appreciation, no one's going to act according to it. So therefore, those who are not interested in devotional service, they will be attracted to the Shastra because of the Gyan, or because of the benefits of karma. Does that make sense? Something they'll be attracted by. That will make them at least pious. They'll follow the scriptures. Because unless the scriptures are established, you cannot establish the other 9 points of devotional service. They're based on the scriptures. Right? So therefore, that must be established. So even if they're just very materialistic persons, there are scriptures that will deal with that so that they can be connected to the scripture. Because the principles, whether it's piety, whether it's karma, jnana, or yoga, or bhakti, the principles of action are the same. What changes is the mentality. Right? So whether you're a karmi, or a jnani, or a yogi, you still have to have a guru. You still have Shastra, you have Guru, you have your great personalities beforehand, like the kings are talking about, Yayati, he did such great sacrifice, or this one or that one. So they're special personalities. Right? They're the ones they hear from. Does that make sense? So Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra is in place for anybody following the Vedic culture. Right? Sadhana is in place. There's always a process to get a goal. Right? So there's the field yourself, there's the field of action, there's what proper activities you're supposed to do according to Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. There's, based on that, the proper activity that will give you the appropriate result. So we see all the elements are in place. It's just the mentality's wrong. There's a fruitive mentality of some kind. Right? A separate mentality that's separate from Krishna. So because of that, then we engage in these things, and therefore we call it karma. But if you did the same thing in connection with Krishna, we wouldn't call it karma, we call it bhakti. Right? There are yogic Brahmins in Vrindavan. They're doing yagyas there. Right? So the whole culture, everything is there. Right? It's not that it's not there. It's just a matter of, is it connected to Krishna or not? Are we working on the Bhagavan platform? So that's what's being offered here. But it's being done in a very subtle way, because a lot of people aren't interested in that. It means everybody reads this Upanishad. So one Upanishad everybody reads. Right? Others, then, depending upon your particular line or sampradaya, you may read or not read. But Ishupanishad, everybody accepts. Right? So then it has to be spoken in such a way that everyone will appreciate. Right? Is that okay?
But the Ishavasi principle has mentioned that, you know, you do whatever is in your, you get only what's in your quota. So like yesterday for Ma cleaning Europe, you know, just as a joke, we said that we finished our part of service, now it's the time to go and help other boys. So it's like, come on, this is the Ishavasi principle, we did our quota, now they have their quota to finish. So it looks like we are functioning on something higher principle than Ishavasi. So
interesting way to look at it. I hope you remember that at the feasts. You finished your quota, and someone else has some more stuff there, but you don't eat it because it's their quota, right? You know? Or their mom has sent them some sweets, and so therefore that's their quota, and so you wouldn't want any of it or anything. And they wouldn't give it away because it's their quota, you shouldn't give away your quota. Right? So does that make sense? Point is this means according to your position, your duty. What about the rule in Manu that a brahmachari cannot sit around and watch while another brahmachari does work? He has to take part because he is a servant, right? So therefore, if there's service to do, he does it. So what about that rule that has been given by the Isha? That, yeah?
So is it something higher than Ishavasa principle?
Is there something higher than Isha? No, so then there won't be anything higher than the Ishavasa. What is the quota? The quota is to be engaged in service. Right? That's your quota. So therefore, if there's service there to do, and you don't have something else that you're supposed to be doing, right, then you help do that. You know what I'm saying? If from 10 to 12 is time to, you know, do this kind of cleaning and all that, even if you finished your part of it, you still help with it, because 10 to 12, that's your quota. Not that cleaning these two bathrooms is my quota. No, cleaning bathrooms is your quota. Does that make sense? So you have to be able to understand how to apply the principle. Okay? Otherwise, what would happen if, okay, you're all down at the pumps, right? And one guy's cooking, right? So it's very slow. So it's already 5 o'clock, he hasn't finished cooking yet, and you're very hungry. So now you're going to sit there and control your senses because you wouldn't want to go against the principles of Ishavasa and go help him with his service. Right? Like that. So, in other words, you have to apply it in all these other areas, not just how you can be a lazy bum. Right? Like that. Those ones are fairly easy to apply. Yes? No? Okay. Something else? Okay. In his purport to Mantra 5, Srila Prabhupada stresses the importance of the terms saguna and nirguna. These terms are repeatedly used in the Vedic literatures, and the Vedanta schools of thought ascribe different meanings to them. So footnote here. According to Advaita theory of Shankara, Brahman is the absolute truth. On the highest level of understanding, paramartika, Brahman is entirely devoid of qualities and therefore free of limitations, nirguna Brahman. And so at Paramartika, that's why it says Sri Rupanuga Paramartika, like that, is that it's the para means transcendental. So Paramartika means in view of that, but we follow it in that transcendence in light of what Rupa Goswami gives. So that's our line. Brahman is entirely devoid of qualities and therefore free of limitations, nirguna Brahman. Nirguna Brahman is one without a second, in a sense that there is nothing else besides him in existence. The Vaishnavas take one without a second to mean that there's only one Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that he and his energies constitute the sum total of reality. Still, in order to explain the material world, Shankara is forced to introduce a duality in his monistic doctrine. On a lower level of awareness, vyavaharika, there is the appearance of material creation. The living entities and saguna Brahman or Ishwara, who is the creator, maintainer, and destroyer of the universe. Saguna Brahman is the lower Brahman because he possesses qualities, omniscient, omnipotent, etc., and thus is not free of limitations. Right? Omniscient and omnipotent still makes you limited, right? Okay. The Mayavadis take all qualities to be inherently material. God is the supreme controller of the God as the supreme controller, the material energy, the individual souls, and the loving reciprocation between a devotee and God. All these exist on the level of ignorance only. On the perfect stage of spiritual understanding, paramartika, there is only the pure consciousness without any object, nirguna brahman. But then he's saying that there's only pure consciousness, but still pure consciousness is an identity, is something there. Because they're saying pure consciousness, but then that means you're giving equality to the consciousness. So that's the thing, is because they have a certain kind of material desire, then due to the ignorance of that, they themselves cannot even see their own faults, their own mistakes, or their own limitations. You know, it's just natural. In karma, one doesn't see the faults of karma. In gyan, one doesn't see the faults in gyan. Like that. Thus, the Advaita-vad theory contradicts one of the fundamental tenets of Vedanta. The Brahman is the cause of everything, janmadyasya yataha. Since Brahman is changeless, the Mayavadis argue, he must be without any effects. Hence, the material world cannot be real because this will imply a change in Brahman. Thus, in order to save the unchangeable nature of Brahman, the Mayavadis sacrifice the world, reducing it to an illusion only. Is this a continuance of that? Oh no, this is just... Is this a continuance of this? What's below the line? Yes. Oh, I see. It goes through to page 10. Okay. This is like a Brahma Samhita footnote. It's not uncommon. You see in these more traditional things where they're getting into these, that the footnotes, sometimes there'll be, the whole page will be a footnote and it'll only be like a sentence at the top. And that's very, very common. Nowadays they don't use it because it's considered literally imperfect. But as far as getting the point across, it's quite good. Srila Prabhupada refutes the false conception from the position of Vyasadeva Shakti Parinamavad. Right. Right. Because they have this, what is it called? Vyavaharika. That it's somehow or another, one is covered by illusion. But the thing is we're saying is that it's all, how do you say? That they're saying is there would have to be, you're changing Brahman, Brahman is changing. But we're saying, no, there's always God, there's always His energies. So how does God change? Just we happen to be aware of Him or not, that doesn't change God. Right? So now they become aware, so now they think God has changed. They're so powerful, they're so special. No, God's always been like that. There's always been material energy, there's always been the jivas, there's always been this the transcendental position. So they missed this point. Quote, in the Chandogya Upanishad, there's the following mantra. Aitad atmyam idam sarvam. This mantra indicates without a doubt that the entire world is Brahman. The absolute truth has inconceivable energies, as confirmed in the Sweta Sutara Upanishad. Parasya shaktir vividhaya shuyate. Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Lila 1365 purport. And the entire cosmic manifestation is evidence of these different energies of the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord is a fact, and therefore whatever is created by the Supreme Lord is also factual. Everything is true and complete, Purnam. But the original Purnam, the complete absolute truth, always remains the same. Purnat Purnam Udachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya. The absolute truth is so perfect that although innumerable energies emanate from Him and manifest creations which appear to be different from Him, He nevertheless maintains His personality. He never deteriorates under any circumstance. It is to be concluded that the entire cosmic manifestation is a transformation of the energy of the Supreme Lord, not of the Supreme Lord or Absolute Truth Himself, who always remains the same. Right? Catch that? It means, in other words, the Lord's energy is transformed, He doesn't transform. Right? So that means then you can get so many variations off something, because you can take, you start with the, you know, a potato, and then you peel the potato, it's transformed, then you cut it up, it's transformed, right? Then you cook it, it's transformed. So the energies are always transforming. But Krishna, the source of the energy, stays the same. The material world and the living entities are transformations of the energy of the Lord, the absolute truth of Brahman, who is the original source. In other words, the absolute truth, Brahman, is the original ingredient, and the other manifestations are transformations of this ingredient. This is also confirmed in the Taittiriya Upanishad 3.1. This entire cosmic manifestation is made possible by the absolute truth, the personality of Godhead. 3.1. That's Bhriguvali. In this verse, it is indicated that Brahman, the absolute truth, is the original cause, and that the living entities, jivas, and the cosmic manifestation are effects of this cause. The cause being a fact, the effects are also factual. They are not illusion. CC, Adilila 7.121 purport. Establishing this theory of illusion, Brahma Satya Jagan Mitya, Shankara quotes an analogy from Svetashvatara Upanishad. The Upanishad speaks about the magician who, quote, is a juggler only for those who are deceived by his tricks and who fancy that they perceive the objects conjured up. But to the discerning few who see through the trick and have no illusion, the juggler fails to be a juggler. Similarly, those who believe in the world show think of God through his show and call him its creator. But for those wise few who know that the world is mere show, there is neither any real world nor any real creator. This is their idea. It's very clever, but at the same time, as you know, it sounds good because we want to come to the position that, because the conclusion of this, if you believe it, is I'm God. So since that's one of the reasons we're here, that's why the mind doesn't mind, being influenced by these ideas. Right? Because you can say, yes, he's not a juggler anymore. But the point is he's still standing there with whatever he's juggling and doing it. The point is the mystique of it's gone away, but the guy's still standing right there with whatever he's juggling. Because the idea is to the other person, him as a juggler, it is something of mystique, something special. But for someone who knows what's behind it, it's not special. But it still exists. But they say, because now, it's not special anymore, it doesn't exist. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So the point is if it's in high heels and a short skirt, and it says that, then, you know, that's the culture of it. You know? Oh, what do you think about them? Oh, I don't think about them. You know, like that. You know, so, but do they actually not exist? It means in their mind, socially, they don't accept them. You know what I'm saying? In other words, my world is the only world. Because that's what he's saying here. If I perceive it, but the thing is if they're really being true to the form, whether they perceive it or not, or whether it's going on or not, what does it matter? It's all Brahman. If there's no distinction, why do you distinguish between, a real juggler, you know, the juggler that is... it has illusory powers over me and the juggler who doesn't. Why would I make distinction? Because then I'm saying he's not a juggler, so there's no illusion. So that I'm defining it. You know what I'm saying? So they're still working within their own illusion that they say doesn't exist. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's like, proving a word by using its own existence. You know, what you're not supposed to do, you're supposed to use a different word to prove it. So they use the synonym and say here. So it's the same thing. They're also, you know, just, materialists. But just they're transcendental materialists, that's all. Yes?
It's all word jugglery. So the claim of rejecting something that's not useful, they sacrifice everything.
Yeah, it said there they sacrifice the world, because that's the great, I've sacrificed the world, as if it's theirs to sacrifice, because then there's ownership, but ownership is bogus, so how can they sacrifice it? You can only sacrifice something that's in your control. You know what I'm saying? So all these underlying, you can see, all it is they want to be the controller. That's the main thing. God shouldn't be, I should be. Others are not the controller. In other words, the juggler is not the controller because I understand his juggling, you know. So I'm not controlled by it. And so therefore, now I can sacrifice. So it's all false ego. That's why they're all worshippers of Lord Shiva. Because it's just ignorance, it's illusion. Yes.
They're using sleight of hand.
Yes. They're using, instead of physical sleight of hand, they're using intellectual sleight of hand. Sleight of mind, whatever. Yeah. No, it's interesting when it's pointed out. That's why these things are very important, because otherwise we use these things ourselves sometimes. Someone will just say, you know, something, and emotionally we'll just accept it. So now if that's appropriate, then that's good. That's just social, proper social interaction in that. But if we're using it to avoid Krishna consciousness or surrender, then it's a mistake. You know, that's why then the shastra is used to please Krishna, right? Not used to please herself. So you have to be very, very careful like that. So the point will apply also in just day-to-day dealings. We'll sometimes say, you know, this is all right. Does that make sense? You know, it's my word. Everybody's saying, what does everybody mean? It means when I walked out of my house and I bumped into my friend, I mentioned to him what I was thinking, and he agreed. That's everybody. Now I go into the meeting and says, you know, everybody says. But who is this everybody? Right? It's only his world. So that's his point, is my world is real, everything else is not. So even there we're using that principle. Right? And that's just the principle of politics and gossip. But it's still based on the same fundamentals, not as sophisticated as the Mayavadis are using. Because we'll use it, but not put a philosophy to it. Well, they'll put a philosophy to it, so that gives them their special position. Like that. You okay? Okay. Establishing his theory of... Okay, the fact that the wise, quote, wise few can penetrate through the tricks of the juggler does not entail that the juggler and his audience do not exist. The Mayavadis claim that they are the few chosen wise men because they don't accept the Creator as real. Does that make them Jewish? They are the chosen, right? They are the few chosen men because they don't accept the Creator as real. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, however, a person who does not recognize the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is considered a fool. Quote, being beyond the range of limited sense perception, you are the eternally irreproachable factor covered by the curtain of deluding energy. You are invisible to the foolish observer, exactly as an actor dressed as a player is not recognized. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.8.19. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Quote, fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the Supreme Lord of all that be. Bhagavad Gita 9.11. And again, quote, I am never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent. For them I am covered by my internal potency, and therefore they do not know that I am unborn and infallible. Bhagavad Gita 7.25. Okay, so we have more. Right? It goes through the bottom of 10, right?
No, it ends.
It ends there. Oh, so this is another line here. Okay, so then this last set. Since the Lord is the absolute reality, the material world cannot be false. It is just an inferior energy of the Supreme Lord. The inferiority does not imply falsity. What is false is not the Lord's energy, but the perverted way we perceive her. The conditioned soul takes Maya to be without any connection with Krishna, and this false conclusion is called an illusion. Everything we see is Krishna only, but when we see Krishna and do not recognize him, this is illusion and ignorance. The illusion, thus, is the Purusha Bhava, the conviction that I am the controller and enjoyer. Ishvaroham aham bhogi. Bhagavad Gita 16.14. Right, so in other words, it's there. So Prabhupada's pointing out is it exists, but it's if the person that's created it exists, what he creates also exists. Like that. So that's the whole point, is that he's there, but he can't be seen by the foolish, because he is, all the contradictions are there. So that's what I'll say. It will be contradictory if you say he's the Lord. But that's the whole point. That's what makes him God. Right? We are not contradictory because we're not God. So, but Krishna is, because everything is coming from him, right? Everything doesn't come from us. So there's no contradiction, right? But with Krishna, everything does. But at the same time, it says he's non-dual, right? So there is no contradiction. It's all him. But at the same time as saying that he's non-dual, he still remains separately as his, as a person, as himself. Okay? We'll end here for the day.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.